Now, what do the following people have in common? I think you'll get it by about the second name. Let's see how you get on. What do the following people have in common? Rick Mayall, Robin Williams, Shirley Temple, Clarissa Dixon Wright, Kate O'Mara, Bob Hoskins, Peaches Geldof, Eli Waller, as in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, Dora Bryan, Lauren Bacall, Richard Attenborough, Richard Keel, Roger Lloyd Pack, my name is Trigger, Mike Smith, Linda Bellingham, Alvin Stardust, P.D. James, Lindsay DePaul, Aka Bilk, and Casey Kasem, who's the voice of Shaggy in Scooby-Doo. So what do they all have in common? Well, they all died in 2014. Now, I've started a sermon like that before. Why do it again? Because I think this time those deaths have made me stop and think. Maybe it's because their names and faces, which I felt have always been around, they're sort of, many of them, sort of part of the mood music of my life. And to know that those people are no longer here has made me stop and think. It's made me dwell on my own mortality. And my parents are dead. But they died when I was a young man. So in my thinking then, I still had plenty of years left. But now those who are dying are not so much older than me. And so death doesn't seem so very far away. And anyway, even thinking like that is stupid. One of my sons told me that three of his schoolmates are already dead. They didn't even make 20. So why should I expect my 70 years and 10? Our sense of permanence is an illusion. So as I've read some of those obituaries, I think I've read it with a greater self-consciousness or a greater awareness of my own mortality. Maybe there's been a greater seriousness. What did they do with their lives? What am I doing with my life? How do they spend their last days, especially when for some of them they didn't know it was their last days? How will I spend mine? Maybe I'm in my last days. What were their last words? What were the last words they heard? Did they die well? Will I die well? What is a good death? Why do we die? So we're going to think about death this evening. And we're going to think about it in the company of Moses. So please have that psalm open in front of you. We're told it's a prayer of Moses, the man of God. Psalm 90. Now, why is Moses thinking about death? Because as he leads the children of Israel through the wilderness to the promised land, he witnesses the death of a whole generation. Moses is confronted by death every day. He's a man who's thought long and hard about death. So I want to know what Moses has to say. I want to get alongside him. Or maybe you're thinking, well, okay, Sunday evening, it's a bit heavy, isn't it? Thinking about death. Is it? Psalm 90 is in the Book of Common Prayer. And if you know anything about the Book of Common Prayer, it was appointed to be read in Church of England churches. And Psalm 90 was appointed to be read at Church of England funerals. So for generations, Psalm 90 was read. Funeral after funeral after funeral after funeral. Generation after generation after generation. So much so that Psalm 90 got into the paws and under the nails of our forebears. And this is what they heard. Different translation. The days of our age are 70 years and 10. And though men be so strong that they come to 80 years, yet is their strength then but labor and sorrow. So soon passeth it away, and we are gone. But who regardeth the power of thy wrath? For even thereafter, as a man feareth, so is thy displeasure. Oh, teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. That was what was read at funerals. Isn't that a bit harsh? Go to a funeral and they're talking about our days passing in his wrath. But you see, the wound was to heal. It's read at funerals because it's a word to the living before it's too late. It's a rehearsal of the realities of our existence. So that when my time comes, as surely it will, that I'll be ready to die. So please have that psalm open in front of you. And we have three things to say this evening, 3 points. And point number one is the eternity of God. Verse 1. Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Says Moses, before the mountains were brought forth. Think of a mountain. Generations come, generations go, but the mountain remains. It's ancient, immovable, permanent. Before the mountains were brought forth, or even you had formed the earth and the world. Think of the world. Generations come, generations go, but the earth remains. But who is the maker of the mountain? Who is the one who formed the earth and the world? Who then is the one who has always been? Physicists tell me that where you have matter and space, you have time. God creates time. Time belongs to this creation. Time to be born and a time to die. But God, the maker of all these things, he stands outside creation. He inhabits eternity. He is no beginning, no end, the first, the last. Verse 2, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So as Moses metaphorically treks across the howling wilderness of this world, daily surrounded by grief and sorrow and death, confronted with man's mortality, Moses' first thought is God. Even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. The God to whom he runs. Verse 1, Lord, you have been our dwelling place, our refuge in all generations. I was reading of the experiences of an Italian soldier caught up in the retreat from Stalingrad in the Second World War. And it was the Russian winter. And as they retreated day and night, they were exposed to this freezing, howling wind. And this is what he wrote. He said, the wind wouldn't let up. It explored every part of our bodies, tirelessly intent, on wringing the life out of us. What a joy it would have been to lie down on the floor of a hut for a few hours to be sheltered from the wind. Moses in the howling wilderness of this world, faced with this endless stream of deaths, of the sorrow, of the grief. Oh, if I could just lie down and be at peace for a moment, just to have some shelter. And he seeks the shelter of his God, the comfort of his eternal home. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. You remember as a kid, when you're upset, running home. Well, Moses, as he faces the upset, the bitterness of the grave, he runs home, doesn't he? He knows where to run. And he runs home to his God. My friend, where do you run? Well, point number 2, the eternity of God, the mortality of man. Look at verse 3. You turn man to destruction and say, return. O children of men. Now, when you read the word return there, it's an echo of Genesis chapter 3. You may remember Adam and Eve, they eat the forbidden fruit. It's an act of defiance. They do what God has forbidden them to do, and with their act, sin enters the world. And the consequences are immediate and catastrophic. And God speaks to Adam, and this is what he says. Excuse me. Then to Adam God said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife, and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Adam and his children are under a death sentence. And it's only a matter of time before he and they return. Return, O children of men, before they return to the dust. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Words are spoken at many funerals. For dust you are, and to dust you shall return. The mortality of man. But look again at verse 3. How is death described? Is it described as a sort of gentle friend? A sweet release? Just the natural order of things? Verse 3, you turn man to destruction. That's a strong word, isn't it? Destruction. Death is the destruction of my humanity. And it is. It's the tearing apart of body and soul. It's the unmaking of me. So death isn't natural. It's God's sentence of destruction upon the sinner. Look again at verse 3. Death is irresistible. You can't stop it. You turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men. What ultimately removes me from this world is not famine or war or disease or disaster. What removes me from this world is the word, the decision, the decree of God. He's the one who calls time. You turn man to destruction and say, God puts his thoughts into words. It is said, and what God says cannot be unsaid. David puts it like this. He says, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them had come to be. In other words, even before David was born, God already decided when he would die. So even before my first day, God has already decided my last day. And there's nothing I can do to stop it. Nothing I can do to change that. And when that day arrives, the day that God has ordained, God has decreed, God has chosen, God has said, that's going to be the day, he'll say, time is up. You turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men. So my friend, that day when you think you had a lucky escape, you know, you think, oh, could it be me? I might have died that day. A lucky escape. Well, it wasn't to be that day. But equally, when you wake up in the morning, just because the sky is blue, the sun is shining, there's not a cloud on the horizon, nothing to worry about, all will be fine. Who is to say that that will not be your last day? Because it's not circumstances or means that take me from this world. It's the decree of God. And God has already chosen the day. And I can't resist his summons. I can't delay it. I can't postpone it. So who's to say I'll live to see tomorrow? My times are in his hands. Look at verses 4 to 6. Our mortality is spelled out even further. Verse 4, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. Think of 1,000 years. 1,000 years, we're 2015, 1,000 years is 1,015. Imagine being born in 1015. Magna Carta is still 200 years away. The Battle of Waterloo is still 800 years in the future. 1,000 years being born in 1015 sounds like immortality, doesn't it? But measured against God's eternity, it's like yesterday. 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past. Can you remember what happened yesterday? You can remember various little bits and pieces, can't you? But actually, yesterday is just gone. A 1,000 years in your sight, like yesterday was past, and like a watch in the night. Did you have to get up in the night? Maybe you had to get up in the night for a child, a sick child. But today, when you think back about getting up in the night, again, it seems like that, doesn't it? It seems nothing. How few and short are our days. To God, I'm born and I die within the same hour. The mortality of man. We're all mayflies. We all just live and die the same day. Verse 5, you carry them away like a flood. Death is a tsunami that sweeps us all away. Verse 5, they are like a sleep. Maybe you're one of those. You put your head down, close your eyes. Oh, it's morning. Where did the night go? The time passed unobserved. You think, you know, if you were watching 8 hours pass, I mean, it's bad enough watching 3 minutes on a microwave, isn't it? You think, oh, it's going to take ages, 3 minutes. But if you go through the night 8 hours, oh, but you go to sleep, you wake up, 8 hours have gone. Or 7 hours, however long you sleep for. The time passes unobserved. Well, that's like our lives. The time's gone. You've barely begun and it's over. But I've hardly lived. I've hardly had any time at all. All those memories, all those thoughts, which just seemed like a few days ago. And it's gone. Maybe like a sleep, we're anaesthetized to the shortness of life. We're used to life being short. Perhaps we don't realize just how few are our days upon the earth. Verse 5 again, in the morning they're like grass, talking about people. Like in the morning they are like grass which grows up. In the morning it flourishes and grows up. In the evening it is cut down and withers. I was strolling in Marble Hill Park the other morning and I bumped into a workout class or what they call sort of fitness club or fitness boot camp. And there they all were doing their things. So I sort of managed to skirt round them and I went round the corner and I bumped into another one. And they were skipping and sprinting and lots of unnecessary bending. Lots of St. Margaret's people. Lots of 30-somethings. Gravity was taking its toll. Joints not quite so supple. And the body perhaps not quite so beautiful as once it was. And you can see already that the dew of the morning grass is beginning to evaporate. But soon, without that group, there'll be hip replacements and mobility scooters. The mortality of man. If you're a professional footballer, you're over the hill, aren't you, by the time you're 31, 32? Our lives are no more than a morning and an evening. Someone had on his key ring, eat right, exercise, die anyway. In the morning, they're like grass which grows up. In the morning, it flourishes and grows up. In the evening, it is cut down and withers. But why is life so brief? Why does death hang over us all? And why is it that death is a terror? You know, if you see animals die off, they just go off in a corner, don't they? They curl up, they look like they're going to sleep, and they die. There's no terror to them. The animal just dies. But for us, life, death is a horror, isn't it? Shortly after Alfred Hitchcock's 80th birthday, he was visited by Ingrid Bergman. She said, "He took both my hands and tears streamed down his face. And he said, 'Ingrid, I'm going to die.'" Why do we fear death? Yes, death is God's sentence of destruction. Our bodies will return to the dust. But why do we so fear it? It's because the dust is not the end. I am body and soul. What of my soul? And you see, the terror of death is what lies beyond. The Bible says it's appointed for men once to die, but after this, the judgment. The terror is that death is not the end. And we go to eternity via the judgment. And I know that having never loved God with all my heart, and certainly having never loved my neighbor as myself, when I stand before God in the judgment, there is no way I can prove my innocence. I am a sinner. And says the Bible, the wages of sin is death. The everlasting destruction of my humanity. The unmaking of me forever. The wrath of God, the punishment of hell, what the Bible calls the second death. That's why death worries us. That's why death terrifies. That's why we fear it. It's not the dust, it's not the grave, it's what lies beyond. Verse 7, "For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we are terrified." Every death is to recall to our minds that God is angry with me, a sinner. Verse 8, "You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance," or before your face. Every death is to recall to my mind that God punishes sin. That my secret sins are not secret. I didn't get away with it. I did them right in front of him. The secret's out. He knows all about it. It can't be hidden from him. Verse 9, "For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years like a sigh." Every death is to awaken us to the reality of God's anger. And God's anger is no paper tiger. Now feel the poignancy of those words in verse 9. "We finish our years like a sigh." Some of those who died in 2014, their achievements were immense. But they can't solve this one. They can't solve their mortality. And you think about all that energy and dynamism. And yet, we finish our years like a sigh. A life with such achievements. And there's a final breath. And it's over. Was that it? Was that it? We're a race under judgment. And there's no escape. Verse 10, "The days of our lives are 70 years. There you go. You can't postpone the inevitable. And if by reason of strength they're 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it's soon cut off and we fly away." My grandfather lived till he was 90. At his funeral there was the family. Family friends, but they're only about three personal friends. Why? Because either they were too sick to come, or actually most of them are already dead. Verse 11, "Who knows the power of your anger? For as the fear of you, so is your wrath." See what Moses is saying? He says, you think about death. Think about the bitterness of the grave. Think about the bitter tears, the weepings, the broken hearts, the years of grief. Think about the fear and the alarm of the dying. Think of the ruin of the body. Think of the spirit being torn away from the flesh. Well, you can rage, can't you? But you can't stop it. Think of that final farewell, that farewell to everything. Think about it, says Moses. Who knows the power of your anger? Because all of it is the unfolding, the unwrapping of God's anger with a ruined, sinful, wicked, rebellious race. But, says Moses, that's just the borderlands of God's anger. Think of the millions, the billions toppling over the edge, unprepared, stepping into eternity. In 100 years' time, we'll all be dead. The wages of sin is death. Says Moses, who stops to think about the power of God's anger? For as the fear of you, verse 11, so is your wrath. If death is just the borderlands of God's anger, if it's feeling the heat of the furnace from a distance, then says Moses, who really knows the power of your wrath? It's more than equal to your deepest fears. So we come to our final point, point number three, which is a prayer. The whole psalm's a prayer, isn't it? It begins by him talking to the Lord, and he speaks to the Lord throughout. But look at, there's a request that comes now in verse 12. He says, so teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. You see, we're like passengers on a train. We're all looking out the window, we're on our iPod or whatever, we're all chatting away, we're all enjoying the journey to varying degrees. But nobody seems to want to ask where the train is going. What's the final destination? Or we're like people in prison. And we're under a death sentence. And every day some people are taken out and butchered. And we who remain, we look at each other with alarm. Sometimes we cry. Soon it'll be my turn to be taken out. And what do? We pretend it's not happening. We even invent special phrases to cover the truth. They say, oh, they've just gone next door. And although we're rebels against God, although we're sinners and we're under a death sentence, we're on our way to the judgment, we're in denial. Left to ourselves, we avoid the subject. Sigmund Freud says, no one believes in his own death. So Moses prays. So teach us, Lord, come on, teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Lord, you've got to break in. Otherwise, we'll go through the whole of our lives in denial, pretending it's never going to happen to me. Lord, you've got to break in. You've got to wake us up, shake us up, make us face up to our mortality. In the P&E, there's a very interesting article entitled Whistling All the Way to the Grave. It says this, always look on the bright side of life, tops the chart of most frequently requested music at funerals, according to the Co-op Funeral Care. Okay, so at funerals, the most popular thing, beating the Lord's my shepherd, is always look on the bright side. And one of the verses says this, life is quite absurd and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin. Give the audience a grin. Enjoy it. It's your last chance. Anyway, it's madness, isn't it? There's another one that's been taken outside. And we were left in the room. We're going to sing a song. Always look on the bright side. It's madness. So says Moses, Lord, Lord, teach us. Sober us up. Wake us up. Because one of my days will be the last day. So teach us to number our days that we may not be fools, looking on the bright side of life, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Lord, wise us up to the situation. My friend, are you willing to be wised up? Are you willing to learn? Are you open to God teaching you?
But the prayer doesn't end there. It's an incredible prayer. We haven't got time really to go through it, but we'll run through it. See what Moses is saying? He's like, because I'm a condemned sinner under the wrath of God, I need to get off death row, don't I? That's the big thing. I don't want to sit here waiting for my turn. I need to get off death row. But more than that, he begins by saying, by talking to the Lord. And if God is the Lord, and the Lord always reveals himself as the God of grace, the God of mercy, the God of love, the God who takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked might turn from his way and live. Then, Lord, you've got to step in. You can't leave the human race ruined. You've got to step in and rescue us. Don't leave us in this miserable wilderness waiting our turn. Don't leave us without hope. So verse 13, return, O Lord. How long? Don't leave it any longer. And have compassion on your servants. You've said, verse 3, return, O children of men. Well, we say to you, verse 13, return. Lord, turn back from your anger. Lord, change your mind. Why do our lives have to end like this? Lord, do you always have to be angry? Do you always have to condemn? Do you always have to destroy? Are you always going to be that God? Isn't there another way? Can't you have compassion on us? Compassion on your servants? And since verse 14, our life is over before it's barely begun. Don't leave it a moment longer. Come as soon as you can. Come to our aid, because a moment for you is the death of thousands of us. So if you leave it any longer. Verse 14, oh, satisfy us early with your mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Lord, can't we start again with you? Everything went wrong. Can't we begin again? Can't there be a new day, a new beginning? Satisfy us early with your mercy. Better translation is to satisfy us early with your love. That invincible love. My friend, are you praying with Moses? Lord, I want to begin again with you. I've messed up. I've spoiled everything. I've sinned. So, Lord, if your anger is tracking my every step, Lord, can't you overtake that anger with your love so that your love reaches me before your anger reaches me? Lord, can't you do that? Can you pray that? Lord, let me shake off your wrath, but don't let me shake off your love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Verse 15, make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil. If the sorrows of living in this howling wilderness have tipped the balance this way, oh Lord, can't you tip it the other way? Must life always be weighed down with misery and sorrow and grief? Can't you tip it the other way? In fact, can't you send death into reverse? So there's no more death, and no more crying, and no more sorrow. Lord, return, turn back from your anger. Change your mind. Pour in some joy. Make us happy. Verse 16, let your work appear to your servants and your glory to their children. Again, it's a prayer. Lord, do you want to be known only as the God of wrath, the God of destruction? Can't we know you? Can't our children know you? As the God who forgives. Can't we see another side of you? The glory of your grace, the glory of your love, the God who saves. Does it always have to be like this? Verse 17, and let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Don't let us end our days with a sigh. Can't we be reconciled to you? Can't it all be changed and put round and put back together the right way? So we don't live under your anger, we live under your favor. So we don't end our lives with a sigh, feeling it was all a waste of time anyway.
so I can live my life and know that it wasn't in vain. It's powerful praying, isn't it? It's a man getting his handholds in God and saying, I'm going to wrestle with you over this. Did God answer Moses' prayer? He answered it more than Moses could have dreamed. Because to put it all right, God sent his son. He sent his son into this world, not to condemn, but to save. Not to take life, but to give his life, that we might live. Do you see, the Lord God became a man. And Jesus is his name. And this is perhaps the most incredible thing. He who is from everlasting to everlasting. He lived a brief span. Just 33 years. Just 12,000 days. But each day he lived wonderfully, perfectly, wisely, and in unbroken fellowship with God. And he too breathed his last. But the death that he died was the bitterest of all deaths. He was nailed to a cross. And if the wages of sin is death, then he died that punishing death that sinners deserve to die. And if we, by our rebellion and by our sin, deserve to be consumed by God's anger, then he stepped in between. So the anger of God fell upon him. But that's not how it ended. Because on the third day, he rose from the dead and ever lives. So that whoever believes in him, whoever comes to Jesus Christ, whoever trusts in the one who has conquered death, should not perish, but have everlasting life. Life that begins now. A new beginning with God, where I'm forgiven and changed, where I live for his glory so that my life is never in vain. And at death, no condemnation. On the contrary, those who love and know the Lord Jesus Christ, at death their soul departs to be with Christ, which is far better, says the Bible. And the day is coming when their soul will be clothed again, but this time with a resurrection body, clothed with immortality. A glorious resurrection body to live forever with Jesus. In the howling wilderness, this cursed world, under the sentence of death, no, to live with him in the promised land, of which it says there is no more death or sorrow. Or crying. The former things will have gone and gone forever. He really does send death into reverse. So it is no more. For all who trust in him. Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us. The years in which we have seen evil. It's God just sort of balanced the scales. Oh, it's been terrible, but I'll just sort of swing it back to sort of balance it out. He takes the sorrows from this side, from this life. And he fills this side, eternity, with fullness of joy. And pleasures forevermore. In the presence of God. My friend, wise up. Let's have no more of this madness. Wise up. One day, you will die. You won't know when that day will be. Because it's the decree of God that takes you from this world. You can't predict it by your circumstances. It's not in your hands. Face up to your own mortality. Face up to your own death. And as you sit on death row and you see how many have gone before you, how many have gone out, and you're left behind, don't pretend it won't happen. Face up to the judgment. Face up to the fact that there is the wrath to come. Recognize that with every step you are on forbidden ground. You daren't go out of those doors. You don't know. It might be your last step.
And that's not pressure tactics. That's not just ramping it up. That's just true. None of us know. So as you face judgment and the wrath to come and the knowledge that today might be my last, then understand that Jesus Christ, He opens a door and through it floods the warmth and light of His love. And He says, I've conquered death. I've died on a cross to save sinners. I've done it all. So come to me. Will you come?
Moses spoke of death. Listen to the voice of the Son of God. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die.
And to believe in Jesus is to come to Jesus. To be straight and honest and say, I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to live each day not knowing what will happen. And I have messed up. I am a sinner. But, oh Lord, forgive me. Jesus died on a cross to save condemned sinners. Save this condemned sinner. And come and fall upon His kind arms. And give yourself to Him for time and for eternity. If you do, and you come to Christ, then He says, it will not be then for you death to die. Whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Let's sing a hymn.